This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The biggest, most obvious thing can blind us so we don't see it, like the sun. Now we begin to explore science which warns, as the title in the journal Nature says, future climate forcing potentially without precedent in the last 420 million years. So during the long ages of trees and flowering plants, it has been hot before and often, but maybe not as hot as our fossil-powered civilization can make it. Our tour guide is Professor Dana Royer. He's the co-author of this new paper and a deep-time researcher at the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Wesleyan University. From Middleton, Connecticut, Dana Royer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, and thank you for the invitation.
I appreciate you showing up. This is important science. It's a huge paper, as big as hundreds of millions of years, of course. And first, I think, Dana, we need to dispense with a very common misconception. When a human-made light, like a flashlight, begins to run out of energy, the light gets dimmer. But what happens as the sun ages?
Right, so the sun gets hotter, as do most stars. So our sun creates energy through fusion, converting hydrogen into helium. And helium is more dense than hydrogen. So our sun is getting denser and denser as it ages, and that causes it to heat up, kind of like a runaway train.
And it expands as well.
Yeah, eventually that's, yes.
All right, now, because the sun's power changes so slowly, the brightening of the sun has generally been left out of most climate science that I've seen. You and your team have brought it back in. Why?
Yeah, so when you want to start contemplating very long timescales, tens to hundreds of millions of years, even billions of years, then this slow change that you just mentioned, given enough time, can actually be quite large.
And it's something that maybe hasn't been calculated when people start thinking about what's going to happen in our short-term future.
That's true, yeah. Certainly the paleo climate community has been aware of the brightening of the sun, but thinking about future projections of climate change, which most of us are well aware of, putting the two together, the paleo and the potential future climate changes, thinking about how the sun evolves actually is a very useful, it's a useful way to think about the problem.
How can we possibly know how much carbon dioxide was in the atmosphere 100 or 400 million years ago?
That's a great question. We don't have any way to directly make these measurements, so we rely on indirect ways that we call proxies. And these, the best proxies are something that you can measure from geological materials, say a type of rock or a type of fossil, and what you're measuring, we know, at least in the present-day Earth, varies or is sensitive to CO2. So if you understand how that material, that fossil or that rock, the chemistry of a rock, how that is sensitive to CO2 on present-day Earth, then you, making some assumptions, you can start to infer what the paleo CO2 content would have been. So I work, in my own work, I think about a CO2 proxy that, I think about CO2 proxy that relies on stomatal pores on leaves. So stomates are the holes through which basically plants breathe. They take in CO2 and exhale water vapor and oxygen. And this is a very highly tuned system that is sensitive to many environmental conditions, but including CO2. So if you understand how that system works, you can go back into the geologic past where we have fossil plants and look at these fossil stomatal pores and start to uncover what the paleo CO2 content might have been deep in Earth's history.
Yeah, we got a peek at those methods about 9 years ago when I interviewed Dr. Bob Spicer, and he's working in that field as well. And I also find it interesting that there's something that leaf shape can tell us about whether they're rounded or variegated. How does that work?
Yeah, and that's something that I've worked on for quite a long time as well. So we describe the edges, the outside outline of a leaf, as either having teeth or not having teeth. So here in the northeast of the United States, Maple leaves are a great example of a leaf that has teeth, little serrations. Many leaves don't have those serrations, so magnolia leaves, for example, just have a round, smooth edge. And what we find today on Earth, generally speaking, across the world, when you go to colder and colder and colder places, the percentage of species, and here we're talking about the flowering plant species, the percentage of those species that have serrated margins goes up and up and up, and vice versa when you go into the tropics. So again, we can look at fossil plants, and we can look at their shapes and determine whether they have teeth along their edges or not, and that helps us to understand what the paleotemperatures might have been.
One thing I didn't totally get is, why didn't you include methane and other greenhouse gases like nitrous oxide in your study?
So, two reasons. The first is we don't have any way to infer those other greenhouse gases like we do for CO2. Maybe as our science continues to develop in the future, we might have such a proxy system. So that's certainly an important reason for why we couldn't do it. We didn't have any means to be able to assess those greenhouse gases. But second, we have a fairly good confidence that CO2 is likely to be, on these long timescales, the most important greenhouse gas. And so I think a logical argument can be made that that's what we want to focus in on, is CO2 as the main driver. With any of these sorts of analyses in deep time, there's uncertainties. And so one way that you can help get around or minimize those uncertainties is to look for big signals. So we looked at the last 400 million years where we've had big changes in CO2, fairly big changes in the sun's output. So these other factors, which we think are more secondary, while they are important and they do affect climate, they were likely smaller than the big picture, the big scale changes that we looked at with CO2 and the evolution of solar radiation.
Well, Dana Royer, looking at your paper and looking at the graphs, I was reminded of the hockey stick graph brought out years ago by our recent guest, Dr. Michael Mann. He tallied up carbon, but your paper, of course, is on a very different scale. How do these compare?
Yeah, they do have a similar visual look to them. The processes underlying them are different in the sense that the past, so with both of these hockey sticks, the long stick part, the slow, steady decline leading up to the big, abrupt rise, the historical changes, we're looking at very different types of processes. So with the hockey stick curve that you mentioned, you're looking at the last few hundred years, maybe up to the last couple thousand years. And the processes on Earth that control the level of CO2 in the atmosphere over those short time scales is very different than what we're looking at over these multi-million year timescales. So on the shorter timescales, the parts of the carbon cycle that are important are the processes that I think most people are aware of. You have plants taking up CO2, you have CO2 dissolving into the ocean or degassing back into the atmosphere. So you have carbon moving between the ocean, atmosphere, the land, and the biota that is on land and in the ocean. On geologic timescales, there are additional processes that become quite important. And these processes control how carbon moves from these surface reservoirs, the ocean, atmosphere, and land, how carbon moves from those places to the deep earth, buried as rock, either in organic form, so fossil fuels would be one example, but there's a lot of organic rich rocks, for example, shales and slates, and also carbon buried as rocks in inorganic form. Limestone is a great example. Chemically, this is calcium carbonate. It has carbon in it. So the movement or the exchange of carbon from these deep earth reservoirs, which are very large, to the the surface of the Earth, which again I include the ocean, the atmosphere, and the land, that's what controls CO2 in the atmosphere on these geologic timescales. So very fundamentally different than on the shorter timescales.
Now, there have been more hothouse periods than icehouse times. It's been hotter, and the carbon dioxide levels have been as much as 10 times higher than our pre-industrial levels of 280 parts per million. Earth survived. So why should we worry if CO2 levels go up to 600 parts per million or 1,000?
Yes, a great question, and certainly a question that's asked very frequently. So life survives. I don't know of any climate scientists that would argue that that's what we're worrying about, or that we're fearful about, that you know all life is going to cease to exist. I don't think that's in the cards. But the many parts of the Earth system are going to change. They're going to shift. And so it's a question of how you could think about it from our perspective as humans, how we are going to fit into this altered Earth, and whether that's a place that will be easy to fit into or create a lot of stress. You could also think of it in terms of all the other species on Earth. And I think a very important, another important dimension here is how fast the changes are taking place. So it is true that in Earth's past, we've had levels of CO2, as you said, upwards of 10 times higher than today, so several thousand parts per million. That's happened in the past. It may happen again in our future, depending on what our actions as the human collective is going to be. But the rate of change is very, very different. So in the geologic past, as best as we can tell, the very quickest changes happened on 1,000-year timescales. So the very fastest events where Earth suffered a lot of stress, often associated with mass extinctions, those events happened on timescales of thousands of years. What's unfolding today is happening on 100-year timescales, and that's very different. May not sound like a big difference, but it actually is. For example, the oceans on Earth circulate, and they like a big conveyor belt. They take water from the surface part of the ocean, and then bring it into the deep ocean. And that's a way to transport not only water, but everything that's dissolved in that water, including a lot of carbon. So if we dump a lot of carbon into the atmosphere, as we're doing now, one way in which that carbon is soaked up is by dissolving into the ocean. This is actually what's causing the acidification of the ocean. But it is taking CO2 out of the atmosphere. The deep ocean, in terms of its volume, is much, much larger than the surface ocean. But it takes about 1,000 years for this one cycle of this circulation to take place. So if we start, as we are, loading CO2 into the atmosphere faster than the ocean circulates, that means that for some period of time in our near future, the CO2 concentrations are going to be higher than they would be if we burn the same amount of fossil fuels and put the same amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, but did it much more slowly, allowing the ocean to circulate and pull more of that CO2 into the deep ocean. So this is getting a bit off topic from the paper, but I think it's a very important point that the rate of change is fundamentally important. And for many people, myself included, this is one major source of concern for why, you know, potential future changes, why we should be very mindful of what they are.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest from Wesleyan University, Professor Dana Royer. We're talking about the way humans could create a warming knot seed in the last 420 million years and the research behind that. And a second critical point I noticed, Dana, which you emphasize in the paper, is that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been overall in a gradual decline for the last few hundred million years. Why would that happen?
Yeah, great question. So as we were talking earlier, the sun has been getting brighter. And so what that means, so it's creating more and more energy. And so more watts are being received by the Earth's surface. More energy is being received by the Earth's surface as the sun has gone through its evolution. So this means that in Earth's past, let's say 100 million years ago, let's imagine a scenario where CO2 is exactly the same as today. The Earth would have been cooler 100 million years ago than it is today, even though the CO2 concentrations in this theoretical example were identical. It's because the sun wasn't as bright. So as you mentioned, what we see from the proxy records of CO2 is, on average, there's ups and downs, but on average, CO2 has been declining over the last 400 million years. So what's going on there? So CO2 over these very long timescales is controlled, as I was just mentioning, by processes that move carbon from the surface Earth to the deep, the rock reservoirs deep in the Earth's crust. And one very important way by which this happens is by the conversion, or what we call the chemical weathering, the conversion of rock into soil. So this is happening all the time, and there are certain kinds of rocks that when this chemical weathering takes place and you're forming soil, you're actually pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere. When you turn rock into soil, you're not only forming the solid particles that we see as soil, but you're also forming a lot of dissolved, what we call ions. And this is what ultimately makes our oceans salty. Sodium and chloride are two examples of ions that are very common on Earth. But there's also an important ion that has carbon in it called bicarbonate. And when you weather these kinds of rocks, which are very common on the Earth's surface today, you form this bicarbonate, which came originally from the atmosphere in the form of CO2. And then through chemical weathering, it turns into this dissolved ion, bicarbonate. And then this eventually, over time, makes its way to the ocean. And bicarbonate is the fundamental building block for making shells, this calcium carbonate. You need bicarbonate. That's the building block for making these shells. And if these shells get buried, you know, the organisms that make them will die, and then the shells drift to the bottom of the ocean. And some amount of these shells will get buried and eventually turned into rock, for example, limestone. And this is a way to pull carbon out of the atmosphere. So it's kind of a long story there. But that process of chemical weathering isn't constant over geologic time. It varies for a variety of reasons, but one important reason is climate. So temperature does affect how fast rock turns into soil. And as you might guess, when it gets hotter, that those reactions go faster. Like many chemical reactions, when it gets hotter, this particular chemical reaction goes faster. And now remember, that's pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere. So if the climate is hot because CO2 is high, that's going to cause the chemical weathering to increase, which will cause more CO2 to be pulled out of the atmosphere, diminishing. If you had a rise in CO2, this chemical weathering is a way to pull back down that CO2 and keep it within certain bounds. And so we see this kind of interplay, or this dance between the evolution of the sun and the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere as moderated or mediated by chemical weathering. And the two are linked via climate. And it keeps which draws down the CO2 over those long timescales.
You know, when you talk like that, you remind me of James Lovelock, who observed that the living and the non-living forces on Earth seem to have conspired to keep the environment within the bounds required by life. I mean, it must be so. Life has continued for so long. I know this isn't part of your paper, but what do you think?
Yeah, that's an area I haven't spent too much time thinking, you know, too deeply about. Certainly on, you know, if you could kind of take a dispassionate view of that, those are the links that we see. Now, whether you want to argue that life is somehow conspiring to do this explicitly, I think that's perhaps something that I can't speak too directly about. But it's certainly an intriguing idea, and I think, I don't know, for me, more importantly, just the system that we have, this Earth system, does have these moderating processes, what we call negative feedbacks, that keep the conditions of on Earth, on the surface of the Earth, within certain bounds, which certainly is a plus, is a good thing for most life on Earth, right?
Yeah. Well, now, it seems like most of the things that we see on the larger scale, at least, have developed in the last half a billion years, the living things. So I'm wondering, is there any point in searching for climate models even earlier? Would anyone try to reconstruct the record of carbon dioxide much older than your study did?
Well, I think our community would be very keen to try to do that. There is an interest in understanding climates even older than what we've been talking about today. There was not complex life, but there certainly was life going back at least 3.5 billion years. And so understanding the interplay between bacterial life and climate is of interest to many people. There are also at least two times in Earth's history where Earth got very, very cold. They call these snowball Earth events. And so there certainly has been a focus on trying to understand what CO2 might have been through those snowball Earth events. It gets tricky, you know, as you go further and further back in time, we have less rock that we can study. And our proxy systems, as you go further and further back in time, become less certain. You know, the errors tend to go up. Sometimes, based on what your, you know, if your proxy is dependent on a particular kind of fossil, at some point going back in Earth's history, that fossil group isn't going to be around, right? It evolved at some period in Earth's history, so before that time, you're not going to be able to use your proxy system. So the number of tools we have, they become scarce. The amount of actual material, rock material, becomes more scarce. So it becomes a bit of an elusive thing. But I can tell you that, you know, if we could wave our magic wand and have our way, you know, we certainly would have a strong interest in trying to reconstruct these climates from even deeper periods in Earth's history.
And, you know, as I said at the start, some of this seems so obvious. The sun is brighter now, so if we increase the carbon blanket, that will make things even hotter. And yet I don't recall reading about this in the latest assessment by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It is a big report. Did I miss it, or is this important factor missing?
Yeah, I don't believe it's in the IPCC reports. The main focus of the IPCC is understanding kind of the next 100 years of our climate and where it may be headed. So the evolution of the sun is slow enough that's not something that they need to take into account. You know, the sun's output does vary on shorter timescales, sunspots, and that sort of thing, and certainly the IPCC has addressed that sort of variability. But this very long-term, almost monotonic change is, I think, for a good reason. They haven't. It's not something that they really need to be aware of. But I, you know, where our new study does interface with the folks who are potentially interested in the IPCC reports is thinking about how what we would call the radiative forcing, basically the temperature, but we view it in terms of the radiative forcing watts per meter squared. How our future trajectories may put us on course to radiative forcings that are highly, highly unusual on geologic timescales.
Your paper mentions a time when the Earth was 10 degrees C hotter than it is today. A few scientists I've talked to suggest human civilization, maybe our whole species, could not survive even 6 degrees of warming. I wonder if it's possible, if we didn't survive, maybe there would be no trace at all of this brief burst of unnatural warming.
Yeah, that's an interesting point to ponder. We know from looking at rocks, doing our studies today, that it is hard to discern very, very rapid change. What we usually focus on are the type of rocks called sedimentary rocks. So these are rocks that were originally laid down as sediments. But these are not perfect recorders, these sedimentary archives. For example, sediments that drift to the bottom of the ocean will often get churned by organisms. They call this bioturbation. And for a geologist, this means that your time resolution coarsens. You don't have you can't resolve short, sharp changes as well because it's been smeared or mixed by this biological mixing process. But there are some archives for lakes are often quite good recorders where you can get annual resolution. So these archives do exist, but they're fairly rare. But getting to your question, you know, would we be able to see something on sort of 100-year timescales? Maybe, but you would have to have an ideal sedimentary archive in order to do it.
All right. Well, I hope that doesn't happen. Now, I have one last little bit of doubt, and that is, can we really apply climate physics of hundreds of millions of years to such a short blip as our current century? I mean, I worry very different timescales can make calculations with such large margins of error, they're almost meaningless. Is that a legitimate concern?
It is a concern, and I think what we can rest, my group, the study that we worked on here, you know, the fact that we're looking at very big signals, you know, it's all about signal-to-noise ratio, right? And what your question is touching on, the noise part of that ratio, right? And so if we were looking at small changes in CO2, small changes in the solar output, then I think your question would be, you know, be worth, that would be something that we would want to be very concerned about, you know, whether we can actually pull out a true signal because of all the noise in that system. But despite these uncertainties, if your signal is big enough, and so, you know, our records that we used in the study, we're looking at changes in CO2 on the order of thousands of parts per million, and we were looking at changes in solar output that are, you know, the equivalent of about 10 watts per meter squared. So in terms of CO2, that's about 2 CO2 doublings. So big changes. So it's something that we're always aware of and mindful of and a little bit worried about. But we try to pick, because of those concerns, we try to pick events or intervals of time where we're going to generate or be able to look at large signals.
What will you be working on next?
Gosh, I'm not sure. I am very, very, very interested in this relationship between CO2 and temperature. I've done some recent work on trying to understand what these deep time archives can tell us about climate sensitivity. So that's the general notion of if CO2 changes, how much change in temperature can we expect? In these deep time records, particularly if you can look at periods of time where you have a big signal, getting back to the point I was just making, we can actually, despite all the uncertainties with these temperature proxies and CO2 proxies, we can actually make some reasonably precise estimates of climate sensitivity. And that's that's something, climate sensitivity, that not only deep time scientists are interested in, but people interested in present day climate change are very interested in as well.
We've been speaking with Professor Dana Royer from the Wesleyan University in Connecticut. He's a co-author of a time-breaking paper in Nature. The title is Future Climate Forcing, Potentially Without Precedent in the Last 420 Million Years. You can find details in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Dana, thank you so much for sharing your time and your insight.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for the invitation.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Download all the past shows you want free at ecoshock.org. And let's meet again next week.